Are there any more questions on Pastor 17? I understand there was quite a buzz out in the hall there. Any more questions on 17 before we move on? Yes.
How does this true bet or this wager differ from the one in the Kalama Sutta? It seems like there's also the same sort of...
It's somewhat different in the Kalama Sutta. He says basically if you... And we could talk all afternoon about the Kalama Sutta. But basically, if you realize that your actions are shaped by your intentions, and then you decide to practice the Brahma Viharas as a way of ensuring that your motivation is going to be skillful with regard to everybody you meet, then you can be assured that if there is rebirth, you will, and there's a reward for your actions, okay, then you come back okay. If there's none, at least, okay, you've lived a good life now. That's basically what it comes down to. Here he's saying more that if you actually adhere to the idea that there is no rebirth, you're setting yourself up for a lot of trouble.
So I guess you could say by inference that if you don't practice the Brahma Viharas, you're setting yourself up for a lot of trouble, though that's not
again,
the ultimate goal.
You're practicing Brahma Viharas basically so that you can... I mean, it is possible to practice Brahma Viharas and then lose it, which is not what the Buddha's talking about. There's a cartoon I was thinking of doing. This guy, shouting out at somebody behind his wheel, and it says, 2 weeks of Brahma Viharas lost after 1 hour on the freeway, I mean, you're trying to develop the Brahma Viharas so you can stick with them all the time as your motivation. And when you're sure that your motivation is skillful, then you're secure.
Now, is that enough to reach Nibbana?
No. Just for a good life, just for a good rebirth. Sorry. No, I mean, that's all he says. I mean, you remember he's talking to the Kalamas. They're not dedicated to the practice at all yet. They're still kind of shopping around. And he's saying, okay, if you practice the Brahma Viharas, and this is a good practice for people who are still shopping around, if it so happens that there is a life after death, and there is, rewards for good actions, you'll be acting on good motivations, there will be rewards. And if there is none, then, you're living a good life now.
There are some who argue that passage like the Metta Sutta suggests that maybe you can reach Nibbana through Metta practice, although there's more going on there than just...
There's a lot going on more than just Metta. It also involves letting go of views and all these other things that you've got to do. And the Buddha says you can... just the Brahma Viharas on their own can get you various levels of Brahma worlds. Which he then goes on to be very clear about, that these are an inferior goal. If you combine the Brahma Viharas with the seven factors for awakening, which include analysis of qualities and basically the wisdom factor, okay, then you can go higher. But the Brahma Viharas on their own will not do it. There was I don't want to name names, but there's an English professor who was laying claims that, the Brahma Vihara practice can take you all the way. And he's claiming that you read between the lines of some of the suttas and you can see that the Buddha's talking about the Brahma world, but what he really means is nirvana. He was being interviewed by a tricycle a while back, and so I asked him about this. Hey, what about these other suttas where the Buddha definitely says Brahma world is an inferior goal? Because it was one of those online interviews where you write questions and write answers, didn't write the answer. So. But I understand there's a lot more of this going around right now than the Brahma Vihara is a total practice in and of itself.
Yeah, we've had speakers here that make that claim, or one in particular.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How did you support it?
Well, with the Metta Sutta and I think you were just referring to the Digha Nikaya 13, mm-hmm. Is that, maybe with some of that. I don't remember the exact argument.
Well, the Metta Sutta requires a lot more than just Metta. Question back here.
Yeah. This mic. Oh, sorry.
Every once in a while, or perhaps frequently, the scriptures seem to reveal the influence of the Brahma, of the of Hinduism, of the Brahmanic tradition from which Buddhism arises, or in the soil of which Buddhism grows. Cyclic existence. We're talking this material is about cyclic existence. If we want to really have an abstract term. Mm-hmm. The thing that I find puzzling. The thing that I find puzzling is that in the Bhagavad Gita, there's a big emphasis on relinquishing the fruits of action. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly the contrary. Mm-hmm. And yet, it seems steeped in this overlay that pre-existed the historical Buddha, this ideological overlay. Does that make sense?
I think there's more going on in India than we tend to believe or tend to know. I mean, look at the Buddhist texts contain examples of the philosophical debates that were going on at that time. And there were several schools of thought that said, look, rebirth is a bunch of crock. There is no reward for bad actions, or no reward for bad actions. There's no reward for good actions, and no punishment for bad actions, so you just might as well go ahead and do what you want.
But there's a presumption there. The presumption is that we're inherently bad without some...
No, that particular one is that you can just have a good time and there's no punishment.
Well, that's not... If having a good time is not necessarily synonymous with immoral behavior...
The way they taught it was that there was no such thing as moral or immoral, just do what you like. But the point I'm trying to make is the Buddha was not just picking up a cultural influence without thinking about it, because the cultural influences were being questioned. And the question of is there a rebirth? Even if there is rebirth, is there some sort of karmic law that goes on? And there were a lot of people who were saying no by that time.
Well, it's interesting because the rhetoric of this passage with using that very commonplace metaphor of rolling the dice almost indicates that the Buddha is temporizing already. He's already downscale. You know, he's making this a smaller issue, he's demystifying the whole concept.
Well, on the one hand, he does want to make it. Clear that when you make an action, when you decide what kind of action you're going to do, there is a wager.
But isn't that already stepping it down somewhat?
Well, if you were an omniscient being, then it wouldn't be a wager. He's talking, because from his point of view, he's already had the experience of awakening. He knows there is such a thing as rebirth from his experience of awakening. Now, he can't take that experience out and show it to you. And he's pointing out to you that unlike Christians that say, all you have to do is just believe with 100% your heart and soul, you're going to be okay, regardless of what other doubts you might have. He says, okay, admit the fact that you've got these doubts, you don't know yet. So in a position of someone who doesn't know, it's going to be a wager. And when he's talking about conviction, he's not asking that you pretend that you know something you don't know. You have to be upfront about the fact, I don't know this, but I do have to make assumptions. And that's what a wager is. So he's not trivializing him. He's just saying this is what the human condition is for someone who hasn't had awakening yet. This is why when they talk about choice theory, so much of it is about gambling. Question here?
I have a suspicion that, like you just said, he's awakened, he knew. Mm-hmm. But the last fetter is conceit. Mm-hmm. And Westerners especially have not anywhere near gotten rid of that fetter. Mm-hmm. And if the self is still there, rebirth is nonsense, because it involves such gross improbabilities, given the body dies and the brain is connected to the body.
Well, if you assume that you are basically a physical being with this consciousness, that's kind of a side effect of having a body. then you know, once you have defined yourself that way, then you've defined yourself in a way that the rebirth could not happen.
Yeah.
Now, the Buddha is saying, basically, you have to learn how not to define yourself in those terms and look at the rebirth as a process.
Yeah, I think conceit is a key to it,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which isn't talked about much.
Yeah. See?
I just thought of something. We're always making wages with a life. We just don't know it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you start a job, you think it's going to be good. You start a marriage. We know 50% of them fail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you start out thinking, you know, mm-hmm. and you're always waging with everything you do.
Mm-hmm. And, it's an important part of seeing the uncertainty of human life. You know, you make some plans for your old age, and whoop, heart attack, you're gone. That's it. Mm-hmm. Yes. Question here.
Well, I guess I'm an agnostic about rebirth, or I've also toyed with the idea that Christians go to heaven and people who believe in rebirth are reborn, and people who believe in a ghost life return as ghosts. It seems possible.
So if you don't believe in this stuff, it won't happen?
But I guess part of what I wonder about rebirth is, like, well, if you make the statement that all humans are capable of reaching nirvana or whatever, then if someone is born with a serious disability, they are clearly alive. They don't always live for very long.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The only way they could reach nirvana, I would think, would be is
get
if they're going to be reborn.
Mm-hmm.
Because some people do not have the mental, let alone, or the physical capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Because of birth defects or because of malnutrition when they're 3 years old, that sort of thing.
Over here.
It seems like the whole notion of rebirth, the comma, the believer, the acceptance of the reality of comma pre-exists, the acceptance of rebirth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are teachings about rebirth in the Buddhist time which did not accept karma. That there was this part of you that willy-nilly was going to be reborn had nothing to do with your actions. And when you actually look at the record, I mean, so many people say, well, you know, the Buddha picked up rebirth from his culture because that was one of his things he didn't really think about. He just kind of stuck it in his teachings because he believed it or everybody else believed it. And that's not the case. It was, it was a hot topic. It was like global warming or something, and everybody was talking about it. You know? And there were positions on all sides. There were the deniers, and the ones who said, okay, rebirth happens, but karma is no way involved. It's just whatever, again, it's like a kind of a throw of the dice, or if you were, like the Brahmins held, if you're a Brahmin this time around, you're going to be a Brahmin the next time around, and the next time around, there was no change. I mean, there are lots of different ways that you could see it. I mean, and you look at the cosmos that the Buddha describes, it's very different from the cosmos described in the Upanishads. I was mentioning here the other night when they had this one belief that if you died, you went up to the moon, and whatever food you had sent up by the sacrifice were there waiting for you at the moon. And that's where the devas all live. And then when they run out of their food, they come back down. In fact, that's their explanation why the moon looks kind of chewed on, And then when you come down, how do you come down? You come down as rain. And then from rain, you turn into a plant, and then whatever animal eats you, you get to be that animal. And if you're lucky, a human being eats you. And if you're not lucky, a dog or something. And this is not the kind of rebirth the Buddha was teaching, So it wasn't that he just picked it up from his society. I mean, he saw through his experience. That was one of the questions he asked. Is there rebirth? And he had that experience in his night of his awakening. And as he said afterwards, there are a lot of things he saw in the night of his awakening that he didn't talk about, but this is what he said was important to know the Four Noble Truths. You had to talk about this. So I think it's good to stop and think about why he would make that claim, and don't just kind of dismiss it. Traveling Mike.
The point that my mind is confused by is, if there is no permanent identity, there is no soul, there's no whatever. So whatever it is that gets reborn is not me. Well, so why am I concerned with...
Universal compassion, okay? No, but the Buddha doesn't say there is no entity. He doesn't say there is an entity. He says stop thinking in terms of entities. Look at it in terms of a process.
But even the way you talk about it, it sounds as if there is something that knows what it was before it gets into the new life.
Well, again, if you think of yourself as a process now, you still have memories of what your earlier life, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, up back as far as I was born, but not before I was born.
Well, and the Buddha said he was able to remember back before that.
Uh-huh.
And the question of, was it the same person or not the same person, that was one of those things where he said, don't ask the question.
Okay.
Because we're here to look at it in terms of a process. Now, we're looking here at the moment as a form of babancha, to talk to people who are still thinking in those terms as a motivation to practice.
Right.
That's what it comes down to.
Okay.
But when you look at his technical discussion of how to look at it so that you can get out of it, so then you've got to look at it as a process. And I can't stress enough, his teachings are strategic.
Mm-hmm.
He's not out there to say there is no self, buddy, you forget about any idea of self. You just don't got it. He's not saying that. He's saying, look, this is a skillful way to think at this level in the practice. This is a skillful way to think at this level of the practice. We're not here to figure out the actual nature of reality out there. We're here to put an end to suffering. And this is how you do it.
Okay.
One more and we're going to go.
Oh, there's an eminent neuroscientist in neuroscience that the genetic contents in the brain, neural patterns, dispositions inherited from bacteria and amoeba are still there in our brain.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them in particular said, all that experience is in our brain of the entire revolution of life.
Mm-hmm.
It could be brought into, you know, going through the eons of lifetimes that he claims to have done
mm-hmm.
on the first watch.
Who knows? Who knows what the medium was? That's one of those things he says.
Evidence for that.
Okay. Here's some more passages where the Buddha uses the idea of rebirth as a incentive to practice. From an inconceivable beginning comes transmigration. A beginning point is not evident. Though beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving are transmigrating and wandering on. When you see someone who has fallen on hard times, overwhelmed with hard times, you should conclude, we too have experienced just this sort of thing in the course of that long, long time. When you see someone who is happy and well provided in life, you should conclude, we too have experienced just this sort of thing in the course of that long, long time. Why is that? It's from an inconceivable beginning. In other words, it's so long ago you can't even think about it. Long have you thus experienced stress, experienced pain, experienced loss, swelling in the cemeteries, enough to become disenchanted with all fabricated things, enough to become dispassionate, enough to become released. Okay, this reflection is to give you a sense of dispassion and disenchantment with the whole course of this, which it becomes an incentive to find release from all this. And it also teaches you compassion for those who are in bad states because you realize, I've been there. It also teaches you not to resent or be jealous of people who are wealthy or are well provided, because you've been there too. Mm-hmm. We've all been there. We've all seen it. My teacher once said, you know, those sensual pleasures that you would really like to get, you've had them before. The reason you want them is because you miss them. He said, think about that for a few minutes. It's enough to make you really dispassionate. Because if you get them again, you're going to lose them again. So, and then you miss them again. It's samsara. Okay. And here's another case where sometimes you hear it told that the Buddha taught rebirth only when he was talking to dumb householders. We're not spiritually advanced. Here's a case when he uses the people who are on the verge of arahantship. 30 monks from Pava, all wilderness dwellers, all almsgoers, all triple robe wearers, which means all they had was one set of three robes, all still with fetters, went to the Buddha and on arrival, having bowed down to him, set to one side. Then the thought occurred to the Blessed One, these 30 monks from Pava are all still with fetters. What if I were to teach them the Dharma in such a way that in this very sitting, their minds, through lack of clinging, would be released from fermentations? So he addressed the monks. Monks, yes, Lord, the monks responded. The Blessed One said, from an inconceivable beginning, etc. Okay. The beginning point is not evident, though beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving are transmigrating and wandering on. What do you think, monks? Which is greater, the blood you have shed from having your heads cut off? You've heard about the tears. Did you hear about the blood? Have your heads cut off while transmigrating and wandering on this long, long time, or the water in the four great oceans? Hmm. As we understand the Dhamma taught to us by the Blessed One, this is the greater, the blood we have shed from having our heads cut off while transmigrating and wandering this long, long time, not the water in the four great oceans. Excellent, monks, excellent. It is excellent that you thus understand the Dhamma taught by me. This is the greater, the blood you have shed from having your heads cut off while transmigrating and wandering this long, long time, not the water in the four great oceans. And this is where it really gets into the details. The blood you have shed when, being cows, you had your cow heads cut off. Long has this been greater than the water in the four great oceans. Just all the times you've been cows. Can you imagine? The blood you have shed when being water buffaloes, you had your water buffalo heads cut off. When being rams, you had your ram heads cut off. When being goats, you had your goat heads cut off. When being deer, you had your deer heads cut off. When being chickens... This is one of my absolute favorite passages in the canon. You had your chicken heads cut off. When being pigs, you had your pig heads cut off. And the thought of being pigs that many times, doesn't that kind of get to you? Long has this been greater than the water in the four great oceans. And here we go again. The blood you have shed when arrested as thieves plundering villages, you had your heads cut off. When arrested as highway thieves, you had your heads cut off. When arrested as adulterers, do you realize you've committed that much adultery over this time? Long has this been greater than the water in the four great oceans. Why is that? From an inconceivable beginning comes transmigration. A beginning point is not evident. The beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving are transmigrating and wandering on. Long have you thus experienced stress, experienced pain, experienced loss, swelling the cemeteries, enough to become disenchanted with all fabrications, enough to become dispassionate, enough to become released. I get chills every time I read this. That is what the Blessed One said. Gratified, the monks delighted in the Blessed One's words. And while this explanation was being given, the minds of the 30 monks from Pava, through lack of clinging, were released from fermentations, i.e. they became arahants. So it wasn't just, you know, ignorant villages that he was teaching. He taught people on the verge of arahantship. Again, this is a way of inducing a strong sense of dispassion and disenchantment. So next time you think about it, you know, drive by the ocean, think about all the times you were a pig and you had your pig heads cut. So these are two passages where the Buddha uses the teaching on rebirth and using Babancha, talking about what you were in those times, to motivate you to practice. Here's another passage where the Buddha uses Babancha about past lifetimes. Monks, don't be afraid of acts of merit. This is another way of saying what is blissful, desirable, pleasing, enduring, charming. In other words, acts of merit. I am cognizant that having long performed meritorious deeds, I have long experienced desirable, pleasing, enduring, charming results. Having developed a mind of goodwill for 7 years and for 7 aeons of contraction and expansion, I didn't return to this world. Whenever the aeon was contracting, I went to the realm of streaming radiance. When the aeon was expanding, you have this view, as you said, the cyclic universe. I reappeared in an empty Brahma abode. There was the great Brahman, the unconquered conqueror, all-seeing and wielder of power. Then for 36 times I was Saka, the Deva king. For many hundreds of times I was a king, a wheel-turning emperor, a righteous king of Dharma, conqueror of the four corners of the earth, maintaining stable control over the countryside and down with the 7 treasures. To say nothing of the times I was a local king. The thought occurred to me, of what action of mine is this the fruit, of what action the result, that I now have such great power and might? Then the thought occurred to me, this is the fruit of my 3 types of action, the result of 3 types of action, that I have now such great power and might. In other words, generosity, self-control, and restraint. So the Buddha uses his memory of past lifetimes to, you know, say, this is what happens to people when they do this kind of action. That's how he gained his knowledge of karma. And finally, one more passage here. You've probably heard of the Jataka tales. There is a lot of question about most of the Jataka tales. They're found in a particular collection in the Kutika Nikaya. We were talking about it a little bit at lunch today, because many of the tales in the Jataka tales are actually pre-existing tales from Indian culture about local heroes, local legends. It may have been a way that as people became Buddhist, they still wanted to maintain part of their Indian culture, so they say, well, you don't have to drop your story of Rama, just say that Rama was a Buddha in a previous lifetime, and then stick with it. It's like Buddhism coming to America, and we say the Buddha was Paul Bunyan in a previous lifetime. And Ananda was his faithful ox, you know. However, there are a couple of Jataka-type tales in the suttas. And here's a really cool one. Okay. One day, King Bhajantana said to his chariot maker, "My good chariot maker, in 6 months' time from now, a battle will take place. Can you make me a new pair of chariot wheels?" "Yes, Your Majesty, I can," the chariot maker replied to the king. Then in 6 months minus 6 days, the chariot maker finished one wheel. King Bhajantana said to him, "In 6 days from now, the battle will take place. Will your pair of chariot wheels be finished?" "Your Majesty, in these 6 months minus 6 days, I finished one wheel." "But can you finish the second wheel in these 6 days?" "Yes, Your Majesty, I can," the chariot maker replied to the king. Then after having finished the second wheel in 6 days, the chariot maker took the pair of wheels to the king, and on arrival to him, said to him, "Here is your new pair of chariot wheels, all finished, Your Majesty." "And what is the difference between your wheel that took 6 months minus 6 days to finish and your wheel that took 6 days to finish? I don't see any difference between them at all." "There is a difference between them, Your Majesty. Look at the difference." Then the chariot maker took the chariot wheel that took 6 days to finish and set it rolling. Going as far as its momentum carried it, it whirled around and around and fell to the ground. But then he took the chariot wheel that took 6 months minus 6 days to finish and set it rolling. Going as far as its momentum carried it, it stood still as if fixed on an axle. Pretty impressive skill. Yeah? "Now what is the reason, my good chariot maker? What is the cause why the chariot wheel that took 6 days to finish when set rolling goes as far as its momentum carries it and then twirling around and around falls to the ground? And what is the reason why the other one didn't?" Okay. "Your Majesty, as for the wheel that took 6 days to finish, its rim is crooked with faults and flaws. Its spokes are crooked with faults and flaws. Its hub is crooked with faults and flaws. Because its rim, spokes, and hub are crooked with faults and flaws, when set rolling, it goes as far as its momentum carries it, and then twirling around and around falls to the ground. But as for the wheel that took 6 months minus 6 days to finish, its rim is not crooked with no faults or flaws. Its spokes are not crooked with no faults or flaws. Its hub is not crooked with no faults or flaws. Because its rim, spokes, and hub are not crooked with no faults or flaws, when set rolling, it goes as far as its momentum carries it, and then stands still as if fixed on an axle. Now, monks, the thought may occur to you that the chariot maker on that occasion was someone else, but it shouldn't be seen in that way. I myself was the chariot maker on that occasion. I was skilled in dealing with the crookedness and faults and flaws of wood. Now I am a worthy one, rightly self-awakened, skilled in dealing with the crookedness, faults, and flaws of bodily action, skilled in dealing with the crookedness, faults, and flaws of verbal action, skilled in dealing with the crookedness, faults, and flaws of mental action. This is any monk or nun in whom the crookedness, faults, and flaws of bodily action are not abandoned, verbal action, mental action are not abandoned, has fallen away from this Dharma discipline, just like the wheel that took 6 days to finish. But any monk or nun in whom the crookedness, faults, and flaws of bodily action, verbal action, and mental action are abandoned, stands firm in this Dharma discipline, just like the wheel that took 6 months minus 6 days to finish. Thus you should train yourself. We will abandon crookedness, faults, and flaws in bodily action, verbal action, and mental action. That's how you should train yourselves. Okay, here he's taking a story from the past and using it as a vivid teaching metaphor. But and basically also making the point that Dharma practice is a skill. It requires the skill of a really good carpenter, if not more. Okay, so those are some of the ways in which the Buddha uses the teaching on rebirth in the form of babancha, talking about beings existing or what you were or what I was or whatever. And he uses it for various purposes to get you motivated to practice the Dharma. Now notice it is primarily an issue of motivation here. It's not explaining how to go beyond rebirth. It's just basically saying this is why you would want to think about going up beyond rebirth. Any questions on any of those passages? Jeff?
So how do you reconcile his chastising Sati in Majjhima Nikaya 36 for saying, it's the same self that transmigrates. And then in other passages, he will say, so-and-so died and they were reborn in this realm. It's a linear progression.
Sati doesn't say self, he says consciousness.
But still, how would you reconcile?
Okay, well, it's not, he says it is this consciousness that doesn't change. And then the Buddha says, look, it's your consciousness is changing all the time.
I think he says it's reborn, the consciousness that's reborn.
It's the same self. Sati says it's the same consciousness that is reborn.
Yeah.
And the Buddha says it's a different consciousness.
But then he'll go on another passage and say, oh, this venerable one has died.
Like, well, if you look at consciousness as a thing, the Buddha would deny that. If you look at it as a process, that's something else.
But it was an identity of a person in this life, and now they have an identity in their next life.
Okay, if you talk about the identity of a process, it's different from talking about the identity of a substance.
So he's speaking metaphorically in those passages when he's naming an individual that then...
Again, it is... You can make the same analogy, you know, Jeff Hardin when he was, a teenager, and Jeff Hardin when he's sitting here holding the mic right now. Is this the same Jeff Hardin?
No.
No. Okay. It's the same sort of thing.
Okay.
Okay, so here we go. Any more issues? Okay, now we're going to go rebirth without Babancha. And this is pretty quick. Gosh, we're almost done. I'll have you out of here before 4. Okay, now remember how the Buddha defined being. Being is a process. It's a process that's caused by obsession. It's caused by getting caught up on passion and desire. So here's a question. But Master Gotama, this is Wachagota talking to him. At the moment a flame is being swept on by the wind and goes a far distance, what do you designate as its clinging or sustenance then? And he says, when a flame is being swept on by the wind and goes a far distance, I designate it as wind-sustained, for the wind is its clinging sustenance at that time. This slashed word here, clinging and sustenance, has to do with the fact that fire was believed to burn because it was feeding and clinging at the same time to its fuel. And when the fire let go, then the fire went out. Okay? So as long as fire is burning, it has to have something that it is clinging to. And the question is, when the fire goes from one tree to another and they don't see any physical connection between the trees, how does it go that way? And the Buddha says it's clinging to the wind. Okay? And then he says, at that moment, when a being sets this body aside, is not yet born in another body, what do you designate as this clinging sustenance then? He says, when a being sets this body aside, is not yet reborn in another body, I designate it as craving sustained, for craving is its clinging sustenance at that time. So he's pointing at it more as a process. It's the craving that sustains you. And remember, the being here is no longer a thing. We're thinking of the being as a process of attachment. So the attachment to the craving is what carries over. So he's talking about here as a process. Then he continues talking in the next page, the next passage. Where there is passion, delight, and craving for the nutrient of physical food, consciousness lands there and increases. Where consciousness lands and increases, there is the alighting of name and form. Where name and form here would be physical and mental phenomena. Where there is the alighting of name and form, there is the growth of fabrications. Where is the growth of fabrications, there is the production of renewed becoming in the future. Where there is the production of renewed becoming in the future, there is future birth, aging, and death. Together, I tell you, with sorrow, lamentation, and affliction, and despair. And this is similarly with the nutriment of sensory contact, intellectual intention, and nutriment of sensory consciousness. So again, it's this process of passion, craving, and delight for these nutriments of consciousness that allows consciousness to land there. Now, it turns out in the next passage, it says, well, where do these things come from? They are born from craving. So what you've got here is a process where craving and consciousness form a cause for each other. This is why the process is self-sustaining. Because you've got the craving craving is what underlies the nutriment. Consciousness then feeds on the nutriment. It has craving for the nutriment, and that consciousness and craving gives rise to more craving, which then provides more nutriment. So it's the process that feeds itself.
Is that upadana and karma?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is why rebirth is a possibility, because unless you stop it, the process can keep on going. We talked the other day about three analogies that the Buddha uses when he's talking about clinging and feeding. And one, of course, is just the physical process of eating. Another is the process of a seed feeding off of soil. And the third is this one about a fire feeding off of its fuel. In this particular one, he's talking about how the process is self-sustaining. You don't need to think about a thing underlying it that's going to sustain it, because the process sustains itself. And there are two ways you could use the, you know, the other feeding analogies. The fire one doesn't work here, because fire, you know, basically once it's burned its fuel is out, and it can't burn it again. However, with plants, you know, seed feeds on the soil, gives rise to a plant. The plant dies, it becomes more soil, another seed can land there and can continue eating. Now, if we think in terms of human feeding, the process, the analogy gets so gross you don't even want to think about it. Which is one of the reasons I think the Buddha never mentioned it, that one in this context. But I think it's a useful process to think about. What gets left over when you've eaten? And he's basically saying that's what we're feeding on.
I don't see why it's gross. I mean, we're not actually eating.
No, it's, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll repeat the question. Right. Because he's, as I said, because the process is one of craving and clinging, it is something you actually do something about. You have the choice to bring knowledge to it or not bring knowledge to it. If you bring knowledge of the Four Noble Truths to it, you can stop the process. It's through looking at it as a process that you can stop it. And we noticed earlier when he was talking about rebirth in terms of Papancha, there's only that one case where you actually get somebody to drop everything. Think starting out in terms of a bunch, and then they move to this process of, gosh, I'm going to do whatever I can to stop this process and totally. But when he's talking about how to look at the process in such a way you really can stop it, this is where you have to look at it, you know, as a process and stop the bunch about the I am this or I am that. Just look at it in personal terms. There is this food for consciousness. There is this craving, this clinging. And get the I am out of it. Starving it.
Starving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Okay. So the Buddha goes on in passage 25 to give an analogy. It says, like the earth property is how the four standing spots for consciousness should be seen. Now, the four standing spots for consciousness are form, feeling, perception, and fabrication. Like the liquid property is how delight and passion should be seen. Now the liquid property here is the water that feeds the seed. Like the five means of propagation is how consciousness together with its nutriment should be seen. Now propagation here is different ways that plants are propagated, and seeds are one of them. I can't remember all the other five. I mean, they're runners and clippings, runners and clippings and joints, and I've forgotten what the fifth one was. But anyway, anything that has this property of being like a seed. Conscious together with its nutriment, those four qualities of contact, consciousness, ignorance, and intention. That's like the seed, which will then feed off of the other aggregates, and it's watered by delight and passion. That's what allows this seed to grow. Should consciousness, when standing, stand attached to a physical form, supported by form as its object, landing on form, watered with delight, it would exhibit growth, increase, and proliferation, and similarly with the other four aggregates. If someone were to say, I will describe a coming, a going, a passing away, an arising, a growth, an increase, or proliferation of consciousness apart from form, feeling, perception, fabrications, that would be impossible. Now, if you abandon passion for the property of form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness, okay, then with the abandoning of passion, the support is cut off, and there's no landing of consciousness. In other words, it's through the passion that allows the consciousness to keep the process going. Consciousness, not having landed, not increasing, not concocting, is released. Owing to its release, it is steady. Owing to its steadiness, it is contented. Owing to its contentment, it is not agitated. Not agitated, he or she, the monk or the nun, is totally unbound right within. You discern that birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done. There's nothing further for this world. So when you look at all these things in impersonal terms without bunchizing them, without objectifying them, then you can see that you can develop dispassion for them. And one of the first things that you release, the first things you realize after you've gained release or gained unbinding, is that birth is ended. Okay, that process of birth stops. I think that's really interesting, is that one of the first things that really hits you after awakening is that no more birth. It's immediate. And there are two or three different standard formula for talking about the realization of full awakening, and each one of them is, after there's release, you realize no more birth. That's it. Any questions about that one passage? Mike?
So probably my biggest passion in the world is food. Mm-hmm. I like to cook it. I like to eat it. Mm-hmm. I enjoy it. Is it possible to attain liberation in a state?
You have to develop a very, what's the word? You've got to look carefully at that passion for food. And, there are lots of contemplations. Like every day in the monastery we have a contemplation that, I'm eating this food just to keep the body going enough so I can practice. I don't want to eat it for the pleasure or for the joy of it or putting on bulk or whatever. I'm eating it just to keep going.
I certainly do eat for pleasure and I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. That's probably the question I'm asking.
Yeah, and so you've got to contemplate, okay, to what extent is your eating motivated by these motivations that are blameless, and then you think of the fact that you're eating an awful lot more than you actually need to. And that means you're placing a burden on some poor animal or plant or farmer or somebody out there who needs to do all this work to get the food to into your kitchen.
I've started thinking about that, yeah. Yes.
You probably know the story of the baby in the desert. If I tell this story, nobody's going to leave any don in the box. So I'm going to tell it. Steve told me not to talk about rebirth until everybody had put their don in the box. The Buddha's talking about how you should look at physical food. And he says, suppose there's a family, mother and father, and they have one baby child, and they're going across the desert. And they get stuck in the middle of the desert, and they have no more food. You can see where this is going, okay? And they realize that if they don't have any more food, all three of them are going to die. So rather than have all three of them die, they kill the baby. And get this, they make jerky. And then they make their way across the desert. Now, as they're eating the baby jerky, he says, how do you think they're going to feel about the fact that they're eating their child? Are they going to eat for enjoyment or pleasure or whatever? No. They're going to be crying. I mean, this is our child that we love so much, and this is what we had to do. He says, you should have that same attitude towards physical food. It's in the Samyutta Nikaya 1263 or 1264, something like that. It's called A Son's Flesh. Yes. The detail I like is making jerky. I don't know. Every time we go camping in Utah, we stop off. There's a town in Baker. Have you ever been in Baker, California? And they have that Greek restaurant that's really good. They also now have a store that's called Alien Jerky. And I must admit, I think about baby jerky every time I go past that store. Okay. Whew. Anyone dare ask another question?
Why is vegetarianism not more of a fundamental community in Buddhism? Why are there excuses?
Why the excuses? The excuses for the monks. And that's up to lay people to decide what kind of food they're fixing.
Why is it not an injunction like so many other injunctions we have?
I guess the Buddha, he said he was not going to put injunctions on people's feeding.
In one passage, you used the term transmigration. Is mm-hmm. that the same Pali, or is it that in rebirth? Or the
well, there's a word samsara, which is a process of transmigration or wandering. There's another. I've got samsara is wandering on. I cannot for the life of me remember what I translated as transmigration. Okay, here's the point at which the Buddha describes his own awakening. Okay, first, you know that his first sermon is called the Dharma Wheel? Do you know why it's called the Dharma Wheel? You know why it's called the Dharma Wheel? Okay, back in his time, when you had, and this was used both in philosophy and legal documents, if you had two sets of variables or more sets of variables that you're going to run against each other. Like you say you have three variables on this side and four variables on this side, and then you have to do the whole list of the 12 permutations. So that was called a wheel. You see a lot of this in the Vinaya texts. You know, when they give you a rule and they say, okay, what is your motivation? What was the object? What was the whatever? And then there's this whole list of they go through all the various permutations. That's called a wheel. Now, in the wheel of Dharma, the wheel that the Buddha was presenting was the Four Noble Truths, and each Noble Truth was to be known in three ways. And so he goes through and he lists the three ways that you know this truth. One is that you know the truth. You're looking like this is stress, or this is the cause, or the origination of stress. Then the second thing is you know that the duty that's appropriate to that truth. For instance, with stress, the duty is to comprehend it. For the origination of stress, the duty is to abandon it. For the cessation of stress, the duty is to realize it, and the path is to be developed. So, you know, comprehension, abandoning, realization, and developing. In fact, this is why we have Four Noble Truths, is because each of the truths has a different duty. It's a category that you apply to your experience so you can know what duty you have. Then finally, the third level of knowledge is knowing that you've completed the duty. You've totally comprehended stress, you've totally abandoned its cause, you've totally realized its cessation, and you've totally developed the path. So that's the wheel in the Wheel of Dharma. And here's the Buddhist passage that comes right after the wheel. He says, as long as this, my three-round, 12 permutation knowledge and vision concerning these Four Noble Truths as they have come to be, was not pure, I did not claim to have directly awakened to the right self-awakening, unexcelled in the cosmos with its devas, maras, and brahmas, with its people, with their contemplatives and brahmins, their royalty and common folk. But as soon as this, my three-round, 12 permutation knowledge and vision concerning these Four Noble Truths as they have come to be, was truly pure, then I did claim to have directly awakened to the right self-awakening, unexcelled in the cosmos with its devas, maras, and brahmas, with its people, with their contemplatives and brahmins, their royalty and common folk. Knowledge and vision arose in me. Unprovoked is my release. This is the last birth. There is now no further becoming. So again, here's a case where right after realizing his release, the first thing that hits him is, this is it, the last birth. This is not going to happen again.
It was a birth, though.
Well, his birth as a Buddha was a birth. Okay, then the question comes always, what's left after the cessation of these six sense media? And This is similar to the question about, you know, does the Tathagata exist or not exist, both or neither, after death? Here's Mahagotita and Sariputta. Mahagotita's, he's an arahant. And so I guess you were the case here, when he's talking to Sariputta, he's talking for the, usually for the edification of the people sitting around. He's going to ask some good questions of Sariputta. He says, with remainderless cessation and fading of the six contact media, vision, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and intellection, is it the case that there's anything else? Sariputta says, don't say that, my friend. With the remainderless cessation and fading of the six contact media, is the case that there is not anything else? Don't say that, my friend. Is it the case there both is and is not anything else? Don't say that. Is it the case that there neither is nor is not anything else? Don't say that. So Gaudiya says, okay, how am I supposed to understand this? And Sariputta says, the statement, with the remainderless cessation and fading of the six contact media, is it the case that there's anything else, objectifies the non-objectified. In other words, there is the state of nirvana has no objectification at all, and yet when you're talking about it, you're trying to objectify it. You're turning it into a thing that can either exist or neither, or both. Exist or not, both or neither. And so on with the rest. So that's the ultimate state where there is no objectification at all. So with the remainderless fading and cessation of the six contact media, there comes to be the cessation, the allaying of objectification.
In the Kula Sunyata Sutta?
Jula Sunyata.
Sorry?
Jula Sunyata.
Oh, sorry. There's the four formless, there's earth, and then the four formless, and then there's cessation, and then it says something at the end, but if I recall, it was, there are the six senses. Mm-hmm. Signless.
No, you've got two of them mixed up. Oh. There's the signless concentration, the directed concentration, or something else. You go through those. And then after there's awakening, okay, then after the moment of awakening, as long as you're still alive, there are going to be the six sense media. But that's it. I mean, there's not going to be stress around them.
But no, they're signless. Animita.
No. The animita applies to something else.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But no stress.
But no stress for the mind, no.
What does the phrase signless deliverance of the mind
referred
to?
Okay, the question is, what is the signless deliverance of the mind referring to? There are three states of concentration that for some reason don't fit into the set of eight attainments, and they're usually listed after state of perception, neither perception or non-perception. There's the signless, there's the undirected, and there's the empty. And the signless means that signless can also be translated as themeless. We talk about meditation having a theme. The mind is still, but it's not concentrated on any theme at that point. It's a very subtle level of concentration. The undirected is that there's no active will, and the empty is that it's empty of any stress.
And that's then in turn related, if I remember this, sort of related to the three characteristics, or as you said the other day, the three perceptions. You get there. How you get to emptiness?
Yeah, that's the commentary's connection. I think there may be some in the canon. I'm not sure. But yeah, I mean it is possible to hit these stages of concentration through using the three perceptions. And this is something that people miss. You think that, you know, if you apply the three perceptions, you're going to go straight to insight. Whereas there are some subtle levels of concentration that you can attain simply by applying those three perceptions. So. And those states of concentration are fabricated. Okay, so here we've arrived at the end of objectification, or proliferation, or however else you want to translate this. Okay. The point being that it's a type of thinking that gives rise to conflict, and you will have to use it to some extent in your practice to motivate yourself, both in the sense of defining yourself as capable of doing the practice and wanting to do this practice for the sake of your happiness. You can also use it when you're talking about rebirth as a way of motivating yourself to practice. But there comes a point where you have to learn how to set it aside so you're not putting this idea of the self inside or the world out there on top of your immediate experience, because what the Buddha wants, again and again, the emphasis is look at your immediate experience, because the causes of suffering are right here. And also, all you need to know to put an end to suffering is also apparent right here as well. And by looking at things as processes, it makes it a lot easier to let them stop. If you have some sense that's, you know, if this stops, that's the end of me, I'm out of here, you're going to hold on. But if you learn how to get the mind in the state of, this is one of the reasons why concentration is so important. You have to have a sense of well-being while you're doing this. If you're feeling threatened by letting go, if you're not stable enough, it's scary. But if there's a sense of stability, well-being, you see something arising, this is stress, okay, I can let that go. And then after a while, the momentum of letting go gets strong enough so that even your sense of identity, you can begin to let that go as well. Whew. I suppose I should make a more comprehensive conclusion, but it's the end of the day. That's the problem with these courses. You put all the subtle stuff at the end, and by the time you get to the end, everybody's burned out. So. Any last questions, comments, suggestions, attacks? Yes. Mike? Right there.
This is a very light question. It seems that in the Buddha's time, there's lots of stories of people becoming enlightened, seemingly sometimes very quickly, first time they heard a teaching, and then they became enlightened. And that we don't hear, at least I don't hear about this as much. Do you happen to know yourself, someone who is enlightened?
I've known some people who I think are totally enlightened, yeah.
Are they still alive? Are they in Burma or Thailand? Or?
Wait a minute. Does being in Burma or Thailand mean they're dead? I mean, No, the ones I know are in Burma and Thailand. My feeling is, you know, the Buddha was basically harvesting all the fruit that was ready to pick. And where are those little last fruits that are still left hanging on the tree, hoping to ripen before things get too cold or whatever. But, so yeah, he had it a lot easier than we do nowadays, in terms of his students. Yes? There's an interesting passage where the Buddha compares, you know, there's a case where, this sounds a little sexist, there's a man who is very poor, he lives in a little shack, not the best sort, he has a wife, not the best sort, he has just a plain bed, not the best sort, he has a little broken pot with just a few pumpkin seeds, not the best sort, and yet he can't give them up. And then there's a case of another man who has many wives and a beautiful palace and everything is just really nice, and yet he manages to give them up. So it's not the things you're giving up so much as your attitude. Now in Thailand, especially in the time of the Ajahns, it was the children of farmers who actually had a much better chance than the children of the rich people. I mean, you look at all the great Ajahns, and they all came from very poor families. So I'd say it's really just an individual matter. You start where you are. Question? Do we need a mic at this point?
Yes.
Yes, we do. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do I have no hope of enlightenment unless I give up everything that I love and am attached to?
Learn how not to be attached, you know.
So you can still do it all, but you can't be attached to it. I mean, like...
You do have to give up. You do have to give up some things, you know.
Yeah, I know that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you start out by giving up what you can give up, and then you practice, and then you find, gosh, my practice isn't going any further. Maybe I should give up something more.
Oh, I see. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say give up everything all at once, because that's... it's hard to survive. But think about, okay, what can I give up right now? What can I conceive of myself giving up and give it up for the time being?
So the more you can give up, the better, in other words.
Yeah, the more you can give up, the better.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. In some of your teachings, the little basics tapes or whatever you mentioned once in a while, the Buddha was very clever, every step of the path, he gives you much gold for candy.
Mm-hmm.
like the concentration, the pleasure of that. After a while, you don't want to think about sensual pleasure anymore. So it's like it's not just giving up. From your teachings, I gather, it's you can find the reward in it every step of the way.
The thing is, so sometimes when you're giving up and you don't see the reward right away, and that's where you need the strength of character to say, I'm going to stick with this. And that's where conviction comes in. Yeah. Anything else? Robert?
One last one. Is there a microphone?
Yeah.
So with concentration, Bhante, the aspect of it that's so enjoyable, so that also has to be given up, correct?
Eventually, yes.
Eventually. That doesn't necessarily mean that we should ignore the cultivation of concentration.
No. You've got to keep doing it. It's it is the path. Mm-hmm. And you think about the history of the path, which was the factor that Buddha discovered first. It was right concentration. And when he talked about the relationship among the different factors, he focused on right concentration having the assistance of the other seven factors. So right concentration really is the heart of the path. And you do it. The question of being attached to it, I know of only one, maybe two suttas in the canon where the Buddha talks about the dangers of attachment to the concentration. Mm-hmm. He talks a lot more about the dangers of being attached to sensuality. You think about it for a minute. How many people killed other people over jhana?
So in terms of the middle path, mm-hmm. the bliss of concentration is not the what he's referring to on that side.
No, the middle path is so. That you actually use the bliss of concentration, so you're not getting involved in either self-affliction or sensual pleasure.
Okay. So it's really sensual pleasure that he's talking about in terms of the middle path. Right. That was my understanding.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was struck by your comment that many of the people that were enlightened were children of farmers. Mm-hmm. And I saw a movie last night called Urban Roots, and it's about the insurgence of community farms and grassroots efforts to feed people in these difficult times. And it's set in Detroit, where I grew up. And I think one of the uplifting parts of the film was that people felt empowered, and this skillful part of Papancha, your abilities to cultivating the ability to feed yourself in maybe a skillful way seemed to fit in with what you were saying about the ability to give up things because you have this ability, innate ability to provide for yourself and maybe other people. Do you have any other thoughts about that?
Well, a lot of it has to do with, in John Fung's case, he was an orphan at an early age, and I think it was age 16, he looked at his life, and he said, I'm pretty hopeless. I'm orphaned, I have no connections, didn't do well in school. I've got to make a lot of merit. and so that was his initial impulse, to start practicing. And you look at the society, and that was a time when there was this reform movement coming out from Bangkok, and came out of the royal family, and very educated monks, and they were the ones that basically said, okay, we know what's going on here. Nirvana is no longer possible. Jhana is no longer possible. And so that cuts off the possibility for, any kind of real attainment, if you believe that. And John Munn happened to be out in the forest, and that particular message hadn't gotten out into the forest yet, and so he wasn't bound by it or oppressed by it. And there does come that point where you say, look, it doesn't matter what they're saying about what I can and can't do. I'm going to practice. And a lot of it is motivated just by As Ajahn Mun said, Ajahn Mahabhava said, and Ajahn Mun just said he'd seen so much suffering in his life, he just had enough. There must be a way out. You look a lot of his Dharma talks, and he's talking to children of peasants, and he's saying, look, you've got what it takes. You've got a human body. You've got a human mind. That's all you need. Just put in the effort and use your powers of observation to the best you can. That's what it takes. So even though this is sounds very complex, I mean, you start taking things apart, and you can recognize, okay, this is a process I can watch. It's right in my immediate experience. And this is, again, what the Buddha is getting at. All you need to know or need to deal with is something you can experience directly. It takes, using your powers of observation, being very honest with yourself about what you're seeing. But it is something that's possible. Okay, I hope this has been helpful. Thank you for your attention.